Pennsylvanians have been dealing with the impacts of the fracking industry for a decade. Now, it's Ohio's turn.
No one ever knows what's going on out there. You know, it's constant. My house shakes. It's like trying to sleep next to a jet engine out there every night.
I'm Kara Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, as fracking moves west, so do the concerns from residents. And researchers are trying to learn more about an aquatic species that could help us clean up rivers, if only it wasn't so misunderstood.
Everyone loves oysters, you know. We eat them. But freshwater mussels are like the ultimate underdog.
Plus, how well do you know your spring wildflowers?
Delphinium actually refers to the shape of the dolphin. There's this little spike that comes out that's supposed to look like a dolphin.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Penn State University researchers will take part in a major international effort to better understand the so-called Doomsday Glacier, a portion of the West Antarctic ice sheet about the size of Pennsylvania. If it collapses, the Thwaites Glacier could contribute significantly to global sea level rise. The National Science Foundation and the United Kingdom's National Environmental Research Council have announced $25 million in funding for 8 research efforts. Sridhar Anandakrishnan is a professor of geosciences at Penn State and will participate in 2 of the projects. He says glaciers are heavily influenced by things like ocean and air temperatures, which humans are affecting by emitting greenhouse gases.
Things that we do over here in Pennsylvania have effects thousands and thousands of miles away in Antarctica.
He says current models suggest the Thwaites Glacier could lead to 3 feet of global sea rise in the next century. Freshwater mussels are nature's water treatment plants. Each mussel can filter 10 to 20 gallons of water per day. But the Delaware River Basin is running out of them, and the ones left are not reproducing naturally. Recently, Philadelphia announced the creation of an aquatic center that includes a large-scale mussel hatchery. State Impact Pennsylvania's Catalina Jaramillo reports it's expected to bring millions of baby mussels back to the river.
7 scientists gather around a water tank the size of a shoebox, staring at a female mussel. They're waiting for the magic moment.
Whoa! Whoa. Did you see that?
I didn't get that.
Finally, the mussel releases what looks like a white cloud of baby mussels.
It's puffing, yes, it's pulsing it out or spitting it out in plumes. It's like, you know, contractions when you're giving birth.
Danielle Krieger is the lead scientist with the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary.
So she's basically bearing her babies. There they come. They're coming out.
Just
dribbling. Whoa!
One mussel releases about 100,000 babies, but not all of them will make it through. Female mussels carry their babies, just like humans, for up to 9 months. But to be able to survive, baby mussels, which look like tiny Pac-Man under a microscope, need a fish, and not just any fish. Every species of mussel uses a specific species of fish. The babies attach to the fish gills and travel with them for a couple of weeks until they're big enough to form a shell and drop off into the riverbed. If everything goes well here in the lab, in less than a year, these mussels will be in the Delaware River Basin, cleaning the water we drink every day. Krieger says freshwater mussels are underappreciated.
Everyone loves oysters, you know, we eat them. But freshwater mussels are like the ultimate underdogs.
Krieger says even though freshwater mussels can't be eaten, they play an enormous role in river ecosystems.
Each animal will filter 10 to 20 gallons of water a day, just like a Brita filter in your kitchen. They remove all these microscopic particles indiscriminately.
Mussels don't just clean water, like trees do with air. They also provide food and housing for fish and other species, like coral reefs do in the ocean, and they can live for almost 100 years.
So they're like conveyor belts, pulling material out of the water, come cleaning the water, using some and enriching the bottom.
Roger Thomas, a scientist with the Academy of Natural Sciences, says before the 1950s, mussels covered the Delaware River Basin.
I mean, the Schuylkill used to have mussels all the way up to the headwaters. Now, they're gone.
Mussel habitats got destroyed, rivers were contaminated and dammed, and people took too many of them, sometimes looking for pearls. Krieger says 95% of the watershed's mussels have disappeared.
We've seen the range, the distribution shrink. We've seen the numbers of animals drop. And many of our remaining mussel beds, there are no natural reproduction going on. There's no juveniles to be found anywhere.
This is a big problem. Without a source of new mussels, it's very difficult for scientists to repopulate the river. Last year, the city opened this small mussel hatchery in the Fairmont Waterworks Center next to the Art Museum. And it's been a good start, but Krieger says it's too small. To repopulate the riverbeds and drastically improve water quality, Krieger says the city needs a much bigger hatchery. And that's about to happen. This week, seven Philadelphia organizations have committed to create an aquatic center that will include a large-scale commercial hatchery at Bartram's Garden. When it opens, sometime within the next 3 years, it will produce about 1 million baby mussels every year. Krieger says what makes this new hatchery unique in the world is that its goal is not only to preserve endangered mussels, but also to clean water.
The possibility that mussel restoration will materially contribute to water quality and swimmable, fishable conditions is very plausible.
Lance Butler is a scientist with the Philadelphia Water Department working on the hatchery. He says investing in mussels will also save the city money. Drinking water comes from the Schuylkill and the Delaware rivers. And if one mussel can filter 10 to 20 gallons of water a day, imagine what tens of millions could do.
They're doing the work for us before the water comes in. They are our ecosystem scrubbers. They are mini wastewater treatment plants.
Then you would have to thank mussels for that clean water coming out of your faucet every day. And if things go really well, even for being able to take a dip in your closest stream. Catalina Jaramillo, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
There's more news about wildlife on our website this week, including the story about a Pittsburgh developer's plan to relocate four peregrine falcon chicks from their nest on a downtown building. And of course, stories from our series, Wild PA. That's all at AlleghenyFront.org. There are native plants and wildflowers we see now in the woods and think, oh, that's pretty. But we have no idea how they might have been used in the past.
Let's say you wanted to make a little bag of potpourri. Put some leaves in it to prevent the critters from chewing on your winter clothes. This is the plant that you'd use.
That same plant? Also good for treating lice. A little lore and history of native wildflowers. That's later on the Allegheny Front. Sometimes when it rains, it pours, and sometimes it pours energy news, usually about the natural gas industry. When that happens, we call on the Allegheny Front's energy reporter, Reed Frazier, to help us make sense of it. Hi, Reed.
Hi, Kara.
So it's been a very busy week. First, you reported on a study that's being conducted over the next months by PJM Interconnection, which operates the electric grid for a 13-state region, including ours. And the goal of the study is to, quote, understand the fuel supply risks in an environment trending towards greater reliance on natural gas. So we know that natural gas has been outcompeting coal and nuclear energy because of its price. Why would relying on gas be risky?
Well, that's what PJM wants to know. And just to back up a little bit, PJM is the grid that, you know, operates in Pennsylvania, basically a region from Washington, D.C. If you take a big paintbrush and paint a big stroke all the way to Chicago. So it's the biggest grid in the country. It serves about 65 million people. And increasingly, it's becoming, you know, kind of dominated by natural gas. You've heard headlines in recent weeks about First Energy, a big energy company, wanting, you know, bailouts and state subsidies because they have a lot of coal and nuclear that's on the grid that's getting threatened by natural gas. And one of the arguments that they've been making is that if we over-rely on natural gas, what happens if it gets super cold for a long time and there's problems with natural gas delivery? Could we have blackouts, like, say, during a polar vortex? So PJM is kind of asking itself that same question. It wants to know, at what point are we over-reliant on this single source? And, like, what's sort of the worst-case scenario? You know, right now we're around 30% natural gas use? What if we get up to around 50 or 60 or 70% natural gas? What then?
So what would fuel security look like?
Fuel security is sort of shorthand for, you know, do you have another way to power your plant besides this one source? So, you know, it could be a natural gas plant that has kind of on-site natural gas, like, you know, storage tanks of liquefied natural gas, which don't have to come in on a pipeline. Like, let's say a pipeline blows or there's a major cyber attack on the pipeline network. You would want to still be able to run your power plants, even if, you know, several big transmission lines go down at the same time. One way to do that is to have, you know, liquefied natural gas roll in on rail cars or some other way. And another way would be to have, you know, if you have a lot of Marcellus shale gas wells right near the power plant that don't need sort of interstate gas pipelines to deliver the gas. Or you could use, you know, liquid fuels like oil or diesel or kerosene.
What about pumping up other fuel sources like renewables?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, the problem for renewables is like they don't function all the time when the sun's not out or the wind isn't blowing. PJM is kind of looking, their job is to look at sort of the worst case scenario and make sure there's more than enough energy on the grid. So they don't see renewables as right now as, you know, an easy replacement for these fuel stable, like, you know, coal plants can just have big piles of coal laying around to crank up the turbines whenever they need it.
So not reliable enough yet. Okay, well, another story that broke this week is about renewable energy, or rather saying no to it. The Pennsylvania Game Commission is declaring a moratorium on wind turbines on state game lands, and that's land that accounts for 1.5 million acres. What's the commission's reason for this decision?
They are saying that, you know, because of threats to birds and bats and habitat fragmentation from building roads to access wind turbines up on these ridges where the wind turbines would be, that would, you know, that's counter to the Game Commission's mission or mandate.
Yeah, so birds or bats could fly into these wind turbines causing mortality. But there is natural gas development on these same game lands that we're talking about. Isn't there an argument to be made that that's impacting wildlife? There's also logging.
That is all true. There are over 2,000 gas wells on Game Commission land. And if we were to sort of expand out to also include state forests, which are another kind of public land in Pennsylvania, you know, combined, there's around 5,000 gas wells on public lands in Pennsylvania. There are, interestingly, no wind farms on any of this land. And a lot of this land is in remote areas up on ridges that would be great for wind development. And in the Game Commission's case, they've had 19 different projects come before them, and they've rejected all 19 for wind farms. And in contrast, they have all this, you know, gas development on their land. Some of that is not, sort of beyond their control. They don't own the gas rights to the ground underneath the game lands. Someone else does. But they do have some control over some of the gas wells on their land. And, you know, it's been observed by some that maybe they have a double standard for, you know, what constitutes too much impact from one industry, the wind industry, and natural gas, which they seem to not have so much of a problem with. And, you know, the natural gas industry has impacted forests in Pennsylvania. There have been research that's shown somewhere between 3 and up to 12% of the core forests in Pennsylvania have been impacted by things like pipelines or access routes or well pads from natural gas development.
Finally, there are a couple of gas-related things happening in Harrisburg this week. Governor Wolf and some lawmakers introduced legislation to impose a severance tax on natural gas. Now, that was a Wolf campaign promise that never went anywhere. How is this time different?
Yeah, that's an old school promise from 2014, right? It's not super different. I mean, variations of this same proposal have been brought up in the last few years by Wolf, and it would basically be a percentage of how much gas you get out of the ground. So if you hit sort of a mother load, well, you're going to pay more. It's proportionate to the amount of gas you get out of the ground. The gas industry vigorously opposes this, and they have a lot of sway in the legislature. which generally agrees with the gas industry, at least this iteration of the legislature.
And there's also a state house bill to loosen environmental regulations on conventional oil and gas drillers that we haven't even gotten to yet. We'll have more about that on our website. Hey, thanks, Reed.
Thank you.
Reed Frazier covers the fast-paced world of energy news for the Allegheny Front. And there's more of his reporting at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. As the shale gas industry moves west to Ohio, people there are concerned about the impact that new well pads, pipelines, compressor stations, and diesel truck traffic are having on the environment and the quality of life in their rural communities. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that researchers and attorneys are speaking with concerned residents about southwestern Pennsylvania's experiences with fracking.
After 40 years raising a family and living on a small farm in Seneca Lake, Ohio, Carrie Bond and her husband are moving out of state.
My community's been inundated with drilling and fracking and waste from the industry.
Bond says many in her community support the fracking industry because of the jobs and money it's brought. So she's not popular when she complains about the drilling activity that lights up the hillside next to her house after the sun goes down.
No one ever knows what's going on out there. You know, it's constant. My house shakes. It's like trying to sleep next to a jet engine out there every night.
Bond was one of about 40 people who gathered recently at Salt Fork State Park in eastern Ohio. Another family was concerned that their wooded yard no longer gets the bird population it did before fracking. And they're frustrated with the response from Ohio regulators.
The lack of being able to do something. The industry has everything locked down, and so people feel helpless.
That's longtime environmental activist Teresa Mills. This feeling of helplessness is why Mills, along with a group called the Freshwater Accountability Project, organized this community meeting.
And what we were hoping to do is to bring everyone together to show that together we can stand strong and we can move forward.
John Stolz told the group that Pennsylvanians have dealt with these issues too. He's an environmental microbiologist at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh.
Got to the point where I finally came out and said, you know, we're not dealing with crazy people. The reality is you've got over 9,000 people calling the DEP over the last 10 years to complain.
Stolz has been studying the impact of fracking on water quality for years and claims the industry has exacerbated the already existing water problems. But regulators, he says, are hesitant to pin this water pollution on the gas industry.
And they want to see a smoking gun. They want to see a chemical that the industry's used. They want to see something that they can pin on. And frankly, the probability of finding that even from the get-go is very, very low.
Stolz wants to start research on how fracking is impacting the water quality here in eastern Ohio. Still, the big question for many people at the meeting, what can they do? Environmental attorney Megan Hunter hears from people concerned about the gas industry all the time. She told the group that Ohio does not have many legal avenues to protect people who feel they've been harmed by the gas industry.
There's just a host of things that are lacking here in Ohio. That Pennsylvania, who is not exactly an amazing role model, but they do have some additional laws that help.
One example, Pennsylvania's constitution includes an amendment that guarantees clean air and water as a basic right. Ohio does not have that. And local governments in Pennsylvania can use zoning to restrict where well pads are located. Hunter says in Ohio, local zoning authority is still in question. Rena Ripple says she understands that lack of control in the face of change can be scary. Ripple is director of the Southwestern Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. Her group works with people in communities impacted by the natural gas industry.
The sense that what was once a rural community is overrun with truck traffic, the sense that you're not sure if your air is safe to breathe, you're not sure if your water is safe to drink, too easily dismissed by the industry and saying, Well, you don't have the data, you don't have the facts. That's not helpful.
Ripple points to research associating the chemicals emitted by diesel trucks and gas infrastructure with health problems like headaches and nausea, as well as cancer and heart disease. The Ohio EPA and the Department of Natural Resources both said in emails they have phone lines for concerned citizens to call. But people at this meeting, including Ripple, feel they're not getting enough response from state regulators.
Do not dismiss these community stories. Do not dismiss these community concerns.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Last weekend, Pittsburgh competed in a challenge that you probably never heard about.
So the City Nature Challenge is really just kind of a fun competition between cities to see who could get the most observations on the website inaturalist.org.
That's Matt Webb. He's the Urban Bird Conservation Coordinator at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. I met him near there in a tree-studded corner of Pittsburgh's Oakland neighborhood to learn more about it.
iNaturalist kind of acts like a big data set of all kinds of nature. Plants, animals, insects, even protozoa and fungi are on there.
It's a citizen science platform where people can upload photos from their phones through the app and learn about what they're looking at in real time through an AI feature that identifies what they've seen. Then scientists can use these data in their research. Over the 4 days of the challenge, Webb and about 150 others in western Pennsylvania observed species like broom moss and eastern chipmunks with their phones, like this.
There are some purple flowers right over here and this kind of thick, round leaf. I'll try to get a good photo of that.
We crouch down as close to the flower as we can get, and Webb makes sure to get its leaf shape into the shot.
And so it automatically put in the date and the time and the exact location where I'm at from the GPS in my phone. And so I've clicked species search. The AI has taken over and it's just searching for what it might be.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, so it identified it, says, we're pretty sure it's in this genus Glaucoma. And then it gives you top 10 species suggestion. And I know from experience that this plant is actually called ground ivy. And that's the first of the top 10 species of the suggestion. So I just hit the check mark, it identifies it at that, and I submit it by hitting that check mark. That is my most recent observation.
I've seen that plant probably my whole life and didn't have any idea what it was.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't know what it was until this spring, until I started paying attention to it. You know, it was always the little mint-looking plant that sat next to dandelions.
One of the most observed species was invasive garlic mustard.
And, you know, that could be looked at as an unfortunate picture of our nature here in Pittsburgh, but I really think what it comes down to is that it's blooming right now.
The goal of the challenge is to make as many observations of as many species as possible. Webb's logged 379 observations alone. Pittsburgh is in competition with cities from Miami to Hong Kong. As we talked, observations were still being checked, corrected, and verified. And though Webb knows Pittsburgh won't get the over 40,000 observations of, say, a San Francisco,
I'd like to try to beat Denver right now. That's our closest competition. They're the next ones above us. And I think that's ironic because I'm from Colorado. So,
for the final result, check out our website, AlleghenyFront.org. And Webb says you don't have to wait for City Nature Challenge 2019 to try out the iNaturalist app.
It was just fun getting out, taking pictures of all the things that I might just pass by in my regular day.
Even with a handy-dandy app, when you're out on a walk or a hike, it can be easy to miss the many wildflowers that might be growing just a few inches away from your feet. They're often tiny and blend into the landscape. That's where a guide like Shane Miller, an interpreter with Raccoon Creek State Park near Pittsburgh's airport, comes in. We tagged along a few years ago as he led a group of Girl Scouts and others through the park's wildflower reserve. Miller gave us the lowdown on the history and little-known uses of these native plants.
The reason I stopped here is there's a little plant that grows here
that I kind of think of as the Rodney Dangerfield of plants. There's just some plants that just do not get respect, and this is one of them. Now you look at it, it has these tiny, tiny little white flowers, nothing too exciting, but in pioneer times, this was a very important plant. Let's say you were misfortunate enough to get lice. This is the plant you'd use to treat it. Also, let's say you wanted to make a little bag of potpourri. Put some leaves in it to prevent the critters from chewing on your winter clothes. This is the plant that you'd use. This one is commonly called cat's toes or mouse's toes because it kind of looks like they're fuzzy little toes. Let me show you one other interesting thing. Let's say it doesn't have the flowers on it. If you turn its leaf over, it's metallic silver. Look at that. Isn't that cool?
I've already seen more than I normally see on a hike.
The reason I stopped here is so I can let you folks know we need to form a single file line to head down this next trail. It is a narrow trail that winds down into the valley here, and then it opens up down at the bottom. We have five different species of trilliums that are here. We have the snow trilliums, which bloom when there's snow out, and we have also what's called the declining trillium, which is a beautiful but unusual trillium that bows down to the ground where you don't see it, and it has a completely white center. So it doesn't have a purple center like the ones these folks are enjoying. Yes, that is a trillium.
It looks like a four-leaf clover with a white flower and like a little pine cone in the middle, like a robin egg.
You can take a look at a plant that's called toad shade. Years ago, pioneers and settlers actually believed that stinky little red trillium over there, and in the springtime, it will have leaves that are green and purple, toads hid under. Well, for the past 10 years, I've been looking and have not found any toads hiding under them, but it's kind of a fun story to remember its name, toad shade.
Poison ivy.
The purple flower that I was pointing out that was on the right-hand side of the trail is one that I bet most of you have in your garden but don't even realize it. That plant is called dwarf delphinium or dwarf larkspur. It's called dwarf because it's a small one. But if you look closely at it, we're going to walk by more of them. There's two different names for it, the delphinium and the larkspur. Well, delphinium actually refers to the shape of the dolphin. So if you look closely at this, towards the back of it, there's this little spike that comes out that's supposed to look like a dolphin. I think it takes a little bit of imagination, but I can kind of see where it comes from. The other one, which is larkspur, where does that come from? Well, years ago, they used to call it lark's foot, and a lark is a springtime bird that you'd see. Now, imagine its foot, but purple, and attached to these flowers. Interesting names. I don't often get to talk about dolphins in the middle of Pennsylvania, but we have a flower that supposedly looks like one.
That was park interpreter Shane Miller at Raccoon Creek State Park Wildflower Reserve. And the hike was recorded by Jennifer Shveta Jordan. For ideas on getting out there and taking similar walks in our region, head over to our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.